Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. Today's speaker will be Lloyd Sandilands, professor of business administration and psychology at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, and author of several books, including The Nuptial Mind, Being at Work, and Love First, Toward a Christian Humanism. He'll speak on the topic on the inhumanity of profit-seeking. Professor Sandilands' remarks were given as part of the Business, Faith, and Common Good speaker series, presented by the Hyder College of Business at Creighton University. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, November 2, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Andrew Gustafson, professor in the Hyder College of Business at Creighton University.
I'm very happy to tell you that we have Professor Lance Sandilands here, Lloyd Sandilands, from University of Michigan. He's a professor of management and organization there in the Ross College of Business, but he's also a professor in psychology at the University of Michigan as well. So he brings both of those things to us. He was educated early on at Northwestern University with his PhD, and then he taught at Columbia during a lot of the 80s, at Columbia University in the business school. And he went over to where he's at now at the University of Michigan in 1989. Prior to that, he taught at the graduate school at Columbia University. He received his AB in psychology from Washington University and his PhD in organizational behavior from Northwestern University. His research focuses on social and spiritual dimensions of life in organizations. Professor Sandilands teaches courses in social and organizational psychology and management to graduate and undergraduate students in business administration and psychology. I've read a couple of his books. The most recent one is Being at Work, which is very interesting. And more recently, I've read an earlier book of his, God and Mammon, which we're doing for our seminar class later this evening. So I would like you to help me welcome Dr. Sandilands here. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Andy. I'm delighted to have this opportunity. It's not always, I don't get many chances to speak to Jesuit college audiences. I'm used to speaking to a very secular world at the University of Michigan, and there are things I can and cannot say there that I think I can say here. So I'm hoping that's the case. I've written a talk with you guys in mind. So I'm going to talk about a paper. It's a new paper for me. I am debuting the paper for you, with you. It is a paper that is my trying to come to terms with the idea of being a Christian business school professor. I'm still trying to figure out whether that's possible. I'm actually still trying to figure out whether a Christian business education isn't some kind of oxymoron, something that really doesn't make any sense when you think about it. Part of the reason why I think it's hard, it may be an oxymoron, is that business schools, for the most part, and the University of Michigan doesn't seem to be an exception on this score, are preoccupied with the proposition of making money, of profit, or the shareholder value model. And that doesn't strike me as a particularly Christian idea. So one of the questions becomes, how do you square the ideas of Christianity with a ethos of making money? So that's the focus. And in some ways, I want to ask the question, what does profit-seeking do for us? And how should we think about it as Christians, but as walking around human beings? So my title on the inhumanity of profit-seeking. Question, does the business school shake your faith? Has the business school shaken your faith? Should it have shaken your faith? Consider this from St. Paul. Those who want to be rich are falling into temptation and into a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge them into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all evils. And some people, in their desire for it, have strayed from the faith and have pierced themselves with many pains. Do you agree that money is the root of all evil? Is that a plausible thing to say? St. Paul is a very wise person. Have you strayed from the faith as a result of being in a place where money is a priority? Or this from Pope Francis. People have to struggle to live, and frequently to live in an undignified way. One cause of this situation, in my opinion, is in our relationship with money and our acceptance of its power over ourselves and our society. We've created new idols. The worship of the golden calf of old has found a new and heartless image in the cult of money and the dictatorship of an economy which is faceless and lacking any truly humane goal. Is our cult of money a dictatorship, a new idol, a golden calf? Are we complicit? You here at Creighton and me at the Ross Business School at the University of Michigan, are we complicit in this dictatorship of the economy? Or consider this from Matthew's gospel. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. Have you made the choice between God and money? Do you see it as a choice? Are you compelled to make that choice? Am I compelled to make this choice? So this is half of the place that I work at. This is the Ross Business School, the most extravagant and ostentatious building on the entire campus. I go to work every day and I have to ask myself the question, who or what do I serve in this place? To what is this a temple? Is that a problem for me? I'm a Christian. Is that a problem for me? So my question for this talk is, how can my or our faith shake the business school? I asked whether the business school has shaken your faith. Let's turn it around and ask how our faith might be able to shape or should shape the business school. So with this as an introduction, this is what I'd like to do. I'd like to begin with a little anthropology. I'd like to ask the question, I believe we have to start with first things. I want to start with the with a understanding of who it is that we are. What is it to be human? And I want to start with that because I want to then ask the question, what does profit-seeking do to our humanity? So I'll begin with the anthropology, and I'm going to make an argument that to understand our anthropology, who we are as human beings, we have to appeal to revelation. We cannot rely on natural science. It would be a grave mistake to rely only on natural science. So I'll argue for revelation. Then I want to turn to the question in very explicit terms, what is it to be human and happy? And I'll try and I'll describe in some detail what I believe revelation tells us about what it is to be human and happy. Having established that aspect of our humanity, I then want to then turn to the question, what does profit-seeking do to our humanity? What happens to us when we put profit before God, when we worship mammon instead of God? That will leave us, I hope, or leave you with a feeling of a conundrum. Oh my gosh, what are we going to do? Business is dehumanizing. Profit-seeking is our ruin. What are we to do? And I want to suggest at the end that Christ actually is the answer and has the answer and has given it to us. And I think his answer will shake the business school. Okay, so let's begin with our anthropology. Who or what are we? How does a fish take part in creation? Without purpose, without reason, without a care or a moment's thought, behind its blank eyes, no mind, only organism. How do we take part in creation? Consumed with purposes, with reason, with cares, thoughts aplenty, too many thoughts, fish or cut bait. Behind our anxious eyes is all mind. We are a completely different kind of creature than the fish. And until we recognize and honor that fact, we can't begin to understand who and what we are. Whereas fish live in nature, in time and space, upon instinct, we live in being. Beyond time and space, in truth, beauty, and good. We are the one creature who knows and cares that he or she exists. The one creature to ask metaphysical questions of being, Who am I? Who can I become? Whereas fish are a what, we are a who. To sum this, we are the supernatural creature, the one above nature, super above, who cannot be described as nature, the one who is a mind, spirit beyond nature. As the supernatural creature concerned with being, we cannot learn who we are from natural science, but can learn who we are only from the one who is being itself, that being God. Thus, our thinking about ourselves must begin with revelation. It can begin nowhere else, with what God tells us about ourselves. This is not part of an ordinary business curriculum, what God tells us about ourselves, but I think this is where our business curriculum should start, business education should start. We, with St. Thomas Aquinas, we must see that to be, you know, there's human being and there's human nature. We are human being. To be human is to love and to know the one who is being itself, the one who is truth, who is good, and who is beauty, namely, God. Okay. So what is it to be? Let's now turn to Revelation. What is it to be human and happy? Well, let's go before Revelation. Let's go to pagan times before Revelation, before Christianity, to Aristotle. Aristotle spoke about what happiness is, and he observed that happiness is not primarily a feeling. It may involve feelings, but it is a condition of the soul. To be happy, said Aristotle, is to be great-souled or good-souled. Christianity builds on this, sees that to be of good soul is to be conformed, not to the world of man or even to the world that we know as nature, quote unquote, but to the one who is being itself in the person of Jesus Christ. This is the great gift of Christianity to the world, the idea that we know exactly to whom we are to be conformed. In a word, Christianity sees that for us to be human and happy, we must be centered upon God. In particular, from Christianity, we learn that to be human and happy is to be an embodied spirit at liberty before God, able in body and mind to love and to know truth, beauty, and good in God's image of male and female, ready to promise ourselves to others in God's love and perfected in the person of God's incarnate Son, Jesus Christ. I'm going to unpack this, but this is, in a word, my description of our anthropology. This is who we are. And notice God is everywhere. There are gods everywhere. So let's examine each of these God-centered claims in turn. Again, we're trying to understand who we are so that we can then understand in some detail how profit-seeking distorts or destroys, ruins who we are. First, our human being challenges us because it is not only natural and of the body, but is supernatural and of the spirit as well. Our embodied spirit is at once of matter and free of matter, at once subject to the limits and determinations of the body and free of will. By the way, natural science has no truck with free will. It cannot render free will. It cannot understand free will. It's beyond its scope to have something like free will. According to the book of Genesis, God grants us a paradoxical freedom. On the one hand, he is the author of and lord over all things, including us. On the other hand, he creates us in his image to act as we will, apart from him. As Edith Stein exclaimed, ours is the one freedom in creation before which even God pauses. He lets us make our own decisions. This paradox of our simultaneous subjection to God and our free will is resolved by the fact that our human freedom is not, as we may suppose, a license to do whatever we want, to pursue our every want and desire. Indeed, we know too well that our wants and desires can addict us, can bind us, but is, to the contrary, the liberty to obey God, to choose his being and his kingdom for our own, and in so doing become the singular person that he created us to be. His truth sets us free. So in this is a little wordy, I know, but in this we come to an initial idea of what it is to be human and happy. To be human and happy is to be an embodied spirit at liberty before God. So our freedom is really that of liberty, not of license. And it refers to God. Second, our liberty for God is to love and to know him in all that he has created. But how can we do this? Again, the book of Genesis offers the answer. God, it teaches, created man to his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. God calls us to himself as male and female in one flesh. Sex, that is, that we are male and female, is the one distinction that God drew in making us. And how could it not be the most important thing about us, given that's the only distinction that he made in creating us? And he did so for the reason he told us, that we might love and know him. We do so by marrying feminine and masculine acts. The feminine act. It's all about men and women. It's all male and female. By the feminine act, we receive God's real being into ourselves to love its existence. As Etienne Gilson saw in Thomas Aquinas, what the sense faculty knows materially and concretely, it knows directly as singular. The likeness which is in the senses is abstracted from the things as from a knowable object. So the first step in our coming to know and love anything in the world, but God in particular, is receiving that being into ourselves. And our model of this, the perfect model of this, is Mary, of receiving God's real being. This is the Annunciation. That's the angel Gabriel coming to tell Mary that she is about to receive being itself. She is going to harbor being itself in her embodied spirit. The masculine act. By the masculine act, we discern what kind of being it is, and thus its essence. Whereas Mary's receiving is a receiving of existence, the masculine act is one of discerning its essence. And all being is a combination of essence and existence. Its essence is existing. As Gilson saw in Aquinas, the universal is grasped while things are being understood. And our model of this from the Bible is Adam. You remember, Adam was asked by God to name all of the animals. And so he did. He discerned their names. He gave them names and brought them into being, established what their essence was. So this marriage of receiving the particular and discerning the universal is just that of male and female in the image of God. All right, so continue our definition here. To be human and happy is to be an embodied spirit at liberty before God, able in body and mind to love and to know truth, beauty, and good, being itself in God's image of male and female. We're making progress. Third, the world-changing revelation of the three great religions of Abraham, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, is that our being is not a what in the world, but is a who in relation to other persons. We are human persons in relation to God, in and through our relations to one another. Thus, in Matthew's gospel, God commands us to love his person with all our mind, heart, spirit, and strength, and to love the persons of our neighbors as we love ourselves. In and by this personal love, which is the love of God, the Greeks called this agape, we come upon the paradox of self-surrender, by which we come into being, that is to say, we are human and happy, by promising ourselves to others. So our third point here, to be human and happy is to be an embodied spirit at liberty before God, able in body and mind to love and to know truth, beauty, good, and God's image of male and female, ready to promise ourselves to others in God's love. Finally, a central principle of God's creation and of our metaphysics is that every being is oriented to and tends toward its perfection. According to the theologian Romano Guardini, all things are related to a reality above and beyond themselves. From this reference alone can they be perfected and carried to fulfillment. Failing the reference to this other, all things, all orders of reality become empty shells. Stripped of their significance, they can convince no one of their root value. We cannot become perfected until we identify something greater than ourselves that we can aspire to, against which we can develop. This principle of perfecting and fulfilling reality above and beyond is as true for our being as it is for any other. And it is this transforming insight of Christianity that the reality above and beyond our being is a perfect human person, the one and only begotten Son of God, Jesus Christ, who is God incarnate, who is once holy God and holy man. So Christianity has given us our perfection. It has identified for us exactly what it is that we are meant to aspire to, and how we are to become perfected. We are to become like Christ. So we have our complete description here now, ending with, and perfected in the person of God's incarnate Son, Jesus Christ. All right, so this was all a long kind of wind-up so we could get to the place where we can now ask the question, what happens to us when we make profit our first good, when we put the good of profit before the good of God, when we, as we do in business schools, it seems to me, all the time, venerate the almighty dollar as opposed to the almighty God. What happens to us exactly? We can now see in some detail. But before we get into the detail, let me say, in general, when we put a secondary good of profit before the primary good of God, we lose both. This is a great insight of St. Thomas that was put beautifully, as is often the case, by C.S. Lewis. This I teach a management course, and this is one of the most important things I teach to my students, this little thing from C.S. Lewis about the ordering of goods and how crucial it is that we get that ordering correct. So Lewis writes, "The longer I looked into it, the more I came to suspect that I was perceiving a universal law. The woman who makes a dog the center of her life loses, in the end, not only her human usefulness and dignity, but even the proper pleasure of dog keeping. The man who makes alcohol his chief good loses not only his job, but his palate and all power of enjoying the earlier and only pleasurable levels of intoxication. It is a glorious thing to feel for a moment or two that the whole meaning of the universe is summed up in one woman, glorious so long as other duties and pleasures keep tearing you away from her. But clear the decks and so arrange your life that you have nothing to do but to contemplate her and what happens. Of course, this law has been discovered before, but it will stand rediscovery. It may be stated as follows," and here we go, "every preference of a small good to a great or a partial good to a total good involves the loss of the small or partial good for which the sacrifice was made. Let me put this in even plainer terms. You can't get second things by putting them first. You can get second things only by putting first things first. From which it would follow that the question, what things are first, is of concern not only to philosophers, but to everyone, and of concern to us, concern to you and I. What is the first thing in our life? And what difference does it make what we pick for our first thing? Well, if Lewis is right, it makes all the difference. Because if we don't pick our true first thing, we're not only going to not get our true first thing by not picking it, we're going to lose all of our things. We're not going to satisfy any of our goods unless we get the first good first. So we put secondary good profit before the primary good of God, we lose both. Let's see now how this total loss happens. And we can go through our four things. First, when we put profit before God, we sacrifice being to having. This is a choice between desires and a choice between freedoms. And it's a profound choice. It establishes who we are. To seek profit is to seek having. Comfort and ease in the things money can buy, self-esteem in surpassing wealth, and perhaps before all, the safety and security of surplus in a world of scarcity. In contrast, to seek God is to desire being, that is the reality of things, which is God's truth, beauty, and good in them, apart from what our idealizing mind makes of things, which is our self in them. This last is to desire God's joy beyond our possessive satisfactions. So this is primarily a question about what we're choosing, what's our fundamental desire. It's also between freedoms. Profit calls us to the freedom of license. The more money we have, the more we can indulge our wants. Ethicist Pinkers calls this the freedom of indifference, as we exercise it by whim. God, however, calls us to the freedom of liberty. The more we are in him, the more we choose him, the more we can be who he created us to be. This, Pinkers calls, the freedom for excellence, because to exercise it is to become more perfect. Call me a sentimental fool, but I still worship the almighty dollar. Well, fool indeed. That's the wrong thing. That's not a good first thing. So for the good of profit, we are first not an embodied spirit at liberty for God, as we said before, but an ego or self seeking license for our every want. Second, when we put profit before God, we exile ourselves from Eden. When we put money before God, we give up on being male and female in God's image. We trade our feminine receptivity, emblemized by Mary, to real being for a faux feminine possessiveness of worldly objects. We don't just receive things into ourselves. We hoard them. We possess them. We try to own them. And we trade our masculine discerning of truth, beauty, and good, Adam's task, for a faux masculine claim of economic value. We put prices on things. instead of understanding their truth, beauty, and good. An example, Edvard Munch's famous The Scream painting. It's a beautiful painting, a very moving painting. It communicates to us. It communicates his soul to our soul in some kind of way. We have a kind of profound communion with the artist and a profound understanding of being when we engage with this painting. By this trade that I just spoke of, we turn real being, what is true, beautiful, and good, into objects to possess for a price. So there's Munch's painting being sold at Sotheby's for outrageous sums of money to people who are quite happy to put a price on it and to own it, to possess it. Thus, for the good of profit, we are not an embodied spirit at liberty for God, not able to love and know the real being in God's image of male and female, but are able only to possess and price objects in the image of our self-interest. By the way, if we can just go between these just for a second, it's important to see just how much is going on. Notice what has happened with the artwork itself. The artwork goes from being a gift of being from the artist to us, a communication of spirit, to a commodity. And our engagement with the art goes from beholding it, taking it into our own being, receiving it as per Mary, and discerning its meaning as per Adam, to an objectification, a seeing it as an object, as a thing in the world, another thing in the world that we can put a price on and trade with others. So it's a profound, there's something very profound going on between these two things. And this is what putting a price on something does. Okay, third, when we put profit before God, we invite an enmity for others. When the objects we seek to possess and price are human persons, not simply objects or even works of art, we take the most heartrending step in our ruin. Then we see others not as fellow children of God to give ourselves to in charity, but as nameless and faceless objects to use for our purposes. Then we see others not as infinitely valuable ends unto themselves, but as contingently valuable means to our end. You remember Kant's categorical imperative that we should never regard someone as a means to an end, as a basic moral principle. But that's what we do when we see people in these kinds of terms. We see them as, for example, as labor to employ, or personnel to deploy, or human resources to capitalize, or customers to exploit, or competitors to defeat. And notice what happens. These are categories. These are abstractions. These are not real persons. This is labor. You know, it's easy to downsize when you think of downsizing simply as that's what we're going to do with our labor. We're going to have a census reduction, leaving all the human persons out of the equation. And then by denying the divine truth of others, we deny our own. This kind of thinking about other people bleeds into how we think about ourselves. And we come to see ourselves and hate ourselves in the same way that we come to see and hate others. I'll level with you, Charlie. I'm going to let money get in the way of our friendship. We see business as nothing personal, it's just business. That's an amazing thing. I've tried a lot of life strategies, but being completely self-serving works best for me. That's what business is all about. What's in it for me? Okay, so for the good of profit, we are not promised to others in God's love, but are promised to ourselves. Finally, when we put profit before God, we put its perfection of efficiency before God's perfection of Jesus Christ. You know, economics has a very clear idea about what perfection is. It's maximizing one's self-interest, maximizing one's expected utility. That's the perfection. That's the thing that by which or through which we become most human, as an economist might argue. The most important thing to say about the perfection of efficiency, or maximizing expected utility or what have you, is that it is not our perfection. While business owners seeking to justify their avarice may want it to be, and while the economists interested to model economic behavior may assume it to be, their wanting and assuming does not make it so. It's very convenient to assume maximization. It makes the arithmetic work out. You can make predictions about what prices are going to do in markets and things like that. Pope John Paul II called our modern preoccupation with efficiency the culture of death. He said, he asked the question, what is the most important thing, the most unsavory thing happening in our lives today? And he said it was the cult of efficiency, because it regards people as economic resources to maximize like any other and to discard like any other when they are unwanted, as, for example, an abortion, or too expensive to care for, as in euthanasia, or too costly to imprison, as in capital punishment, or too unproductive to profit from, as in layoffs. This comes from Diego Rivera's murals at the Detroit Institute of Art, a local art museum for me. His depiction of assembly work in Detroit. You know, and the question you have to ask, you look at, he presents this in very graphic terms. People are devoting themselves to this. And the question we have to ask is this our perfection? This efficiency, this machine that we're serving, that we're answering to? So for the good of profit, we are not perfected in Jesus Christ, but in death-dealing efficiency. There's a lot of carnage going on here. So in summary, we have two columns, seeking profit versus seeking God. And we have a number of things that we can compare them on. And implicit in what I've just been saying is there's a different aim in seeking profit, that is to have things, to possess them, whereas in seeking God, the aim is to be more fully realized as a human person. There's a different freedom in seeking profit. It's the freedom of license, of being able to do whatever you want to do with all the money you've made. In seeking God, it's a liberty. It's a liberty to choose God. There's a relationship to other people. In seeking profit, it's one of exploitation. What's in it for me? How can I get from you what I want? Profit itself is a kind of zero-sum game. For me to maximize my profit, I have to take money out of your pocket. And my goal becomes, how can I think of clever ways to do that? How can I get as much money out of your pocket as I possibly can? In seeking God, the relationship to others is quite opposite of that. It's gift. It's not even a reciprocity. It's simply gift. There's a different ethos, one of self-interest and the other of charity. And finally, there's a different perfection, efficiency, maximizing profit, or Christ. So in summary, again, put differently back to C.S. Lewis, when we put the secondary good of profit before the primary good of God, we lose both. And this is precisely how not to be human and not to be happy. Any questions so far? I want to, before I turn to what I think is the answer to all of this, all this grim business. Okay, let me then say, what are we to do? The last part of my talk. It seems to me, always the case, the answer to our questions is Christ is the answer. What are we to do? The incarnation, the miracle of Christ, is the mystery that clarifies our being. It's the one case I know where a mystery actually clarifies something. But the mystery of Christ does clarify. It clarifies everything about us. God became a person, like us in every way but sin, to teach us how to be human and how to be happy. As Christ tells us, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me, says John. In, with, and through Christ, we learn what we are for and how we must be. Let's go into this in a little bit more detail. What we are for. So in Matthew's gospel, Christ calls us to our true good. Remember, the true good, the ordering of goods is crucial. And Christ makes it very clear that the ordering of our goods is crucial. He says, lay up not for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where the thieves break through and steal, but lay up for yourself treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust nor doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart be also. And then three lines later in Matthew 26:24, he explains why we must choose. No man can serve two masters, we've said all this before, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. We cannot serve, again, God and mammon. So Christ is very clear about the choice that we have to make. Note that Christ tells us not only that it is better to worship God than to worship mammon, but that we must choose between them, because we cannot choose both. So you can't say, I choose not to choose, because that is a choice. You're going to be with one or the other. So that's the question of what we are for. Then we come to the question, how we must be. Question, how can we be in the world of business but not of the world of business? This is the question I wrestle with all the time as trying to be a Christian business professor. How can I be in this world of Christian of business but not be of this world, not be taken by this world, co-opted by this world? How can we be of God instead of being of this world of business? Is there a middle or third way that overcomes the logical antithesis of seeking profit and seeking God? Is there a synthesis of the two? Yes, there is. As happens so often in the gospel, Christ supplies the one mind-boggling, paradox-busting answer that no one else could. And this is from his parable of the talents. I have a colleague who is an atheist, a rabid and angry anti-Christian at it, and he always brings up the parable of the talents as if it's going to be some puzzle for me, you know, because it looks like it's all about making profit, and how can that be? So let's consider the parable of the talent and what Christ is teaching us by it. And I want to submit to you that it actually resolves the tensions in this talk. So here's an image of the parable of the talents. I'll read it to you. For it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted to them his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away. He who had received the 5 talents went at once and traded them and made 5 talents more. So also he who had 2 talents made 2 talents more. But he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. And he who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing the 5 talents more, saying, Master, you delivered to me 5 talents. Here I have made 5 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. And he also who had the 2 talents came forward, saying, Master, you delivered to me 2 talents. Here I have made 2 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. Notice that the 5-talent person and the 2-talent person get exactly the same reward from the master. He who had received the 1 talent came forward saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, you can have what is yours. But his master answered him, You wicked and slothful servant. You knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have scattered no seed. Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own with interest. So he took the talent from him and gave it to him who had the 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more will be given, and he will have an abundance. But from one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And he cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness, in that place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So that's the famous parable of the talents. What does that tell us? I want to suggest that there are 4 lessons here. First, our true master is not any human boss or human owner, but is God. The people with the talents don't get to keep the money. It's not their money. It's not their they're not their talents. It's the master's talents. We are to do as Christ did and does, take our place and do our part in the Father's creation according to the gifts he has given us. This means that we are to obey human bosses and business owners only as doing so serves this end. As Jesus himself commands, we are to render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's, recognizing that everything that is Caesar's is God's. This, a lot of people think that phrase, things to Caesar and God's to God, is a kind of argument for separating business from faith or something like that. No, it's actually a way of ordering the two. It's understanding that everything is under God. Second parable, lesson of the parable. The wealth or profit we are to seek, and this is where my colleague thinks he's got me, the profit we are to seek in business does not belong to us, but to God. By God's decree, we are to work in the world, in business or in everywhere else, not for ourselves, but for him. That is, we are to work not that our will be done, but that his will be done. And the wealth or profit we are to seek is his glory, which for us is precisely his Son, the God-man Jesus Christ. As the early church father St. Irenaeus famously observed, the glory of God is man fully alive, where man fully alive is none other than Jesus Christ. Third lesson of the parable of the talents. God wants us to take part in his creativity according to the talents he has given us. If we obey him in this, then we can expect to be set over much and to enter into the joy of the master. If we disobey him in this, then we can expect to forfeit the talents he has given us, to be set over nothing, and to be banished from his kingdom to a place of weeping and gnashing of teeth. It's very clear. Finally, God calls us to a business discipline more exacting than any concern for economic profit. As hard a taskmaster as economic efficiency can be, God is infinitely harder. While he respects our freedom absolutely, he demands that we exercise it totally and at the steep price of heaven or hell. God wants us to play in a game that's much steeper, much harder than the game of making money in the world. Okay, so those are the four lessons of the parable of the talents. Let me now finally suggest that those four lessons are the lessons to shake the business school by our faith, what our faith has to contribute to the business school. Imagine that these are the principles now that underlie your business education. First, our true master is not any human boss or business, but is God. Second, the wealth or profit that we are to seek in business does not belong to us, but to God. Third, God wants us to take part in his creativity according to the talents he has given us. And finally, God calls us to a business discipline more exacting than any concern for economic profit. Suppose these were the foundations of business education. Finally, one last thought. I was so pleased to get this invitation from Andy to come to talk to you, because I thought, well, this is a Jesuit university. And what is a Jesuit university all about? And then I thought about what the title of this whole lecture series is. You know, it's about, you know, business, faith, and the common good. So let me thank you for calling to my mind a truth that never occurred to me by its title. Business, faith, and the common good. They go together. They belong together. As this is Creighton and not a Jesuit university and not my secular University of Michigan, I'm free to understand that business, faith, and the common good evince one and the same divine reality. They are, each of them in their own way, a society of Christ, the society of Jesus. That is what a Jesuit education is. So thank God for Jesuit business education. So that's it.
All right. Are there any questions you have for our speaker tonight? Yeah, Pierce.
You mentioned C.S. Lewis earlier and primary and secondary goods that we should pursue. And you ended that section saying that figuring out which of those goods is of the utmost importance. Do you think that there's the potential for there to be multiple different goods that we can put at the center, or do they all in some way tie back to Christ has to be there, or do you see any like leeway or room for any other interpretations there?
No, I don't. I am a Christian, so that is to say I have declared for myself, and I try to live along the lines in the belief that that is the first good above all. And that is the good in accordance with I need to order all my other goods in life. I don't do it very well, but I believe that that is. And since I don't believe that my relationship to Christ is unique in the world, I think it's a universal relationship that everybody has, in principle at least. I think there is a common good for everybody, a singular, absolute, summum bonum, greatest good for us all. And I believe that that greatest good ought to be the first good held in any conversation that we have, in any business education or anything else we do. So to me, it all ought to be ordered that way. This is not a relativistic thing, in my view. I'm prepared to be an absolutist about this.
Okay, so you said that like those four lessons from the parable were ways that you can use to shake up the business school. How would you, like, in the real world, how would you kind of apply that to secular schools, like what you teach at? Like, how would you actually implement that change where that belief isn't necessarily held?
I don't know. I have no idea. It seems to me the most important thing in the world, and I have no idea. I mean, I'm trying to do it in my own little small little ways. One is by example to my students. I do in my classes. I have this kind of idea that I want every one of my classes to, in one way or another, point to God. Often not directly, but sometimes with an elbow or something like this. So I think, I don't know how to do this. It seems to me what we need is a metanoia, a revolution in the way we think about these things. I think business education is very far gone. It's very far gone because we live in a modern world. We live in a world of pragmatism where metaphysical ideas really have no home. There's no basis for them. So there's no real, it's hard to get real traction on these things. So I don't know how to do it. It seems to me it's the most important thing to do. It seems to me talking to young people is a start. You know, there's some hope there.
So my question is on a point that you made. You said that profit is a zero-sum game and that your pursuit of it is taking money from somebody else's pocket and putting it in yours.
If I want to maximize my profit, I want to minimize...
Oh, maximize profit. Okay, yeah. So it's not... Is there a possibility that you can pursue profit and therein serve God? I would say, like, for example, Professor Gustafson works in real estate, I believe, and he pursues profit in a way mm-hmm. and helps people along the way. Mm-hmm. Do you think in that way that he's serving God and pursuing profit?
Yeah, I think it's possible. And I think, again, it's the ordering of the goods. If glorifying God is the primary good, then I think it's reasonable to have profit as a secondary kind of good. That would be a measure of how efficiently you're glorifying God. It would be a measure of your use of resources, how well you're husbanding the resources available to you. So it would be a worthwhile thing. But when it's not the chief aim, everything has changed if glorifying God is the chief aim. You know, but when you know, look at a company like, I don't know if some of you have probably read the Enron case. There is a company that glorified profit as the be-all and end-all. And look what it did to the company. It ruined every aspect of it. It's a totalizing kind of thing. So the first good is going to be totalizing. And the question is, what is the first good? So yes, there is a place for profit, but as a secondary good. It's like health. It's good to be healthy, right? We all want to be healthy. That's a value. But health is not the main value in our life. The main value in life is something else. And being healthy enables us to do more of what our main value is.
So I'm wondering, Enron is a good example. How would you apply to an example like Walmart, where they crunch the numbers, they're all about maximizing profit, but they provide a lot of positive externalities, such as, you know, saving people money, giving affordable goods to the common American people. Mm-hmm. And do you think that that's a noble pursuit?
Well, that would be an interesting case to sort of really hash out in some detail, because it's true that the consumers have been a beneficiary of Walmart's operations management techniques and their business techniques in general. But employees of Walmart haven't necessarily fared so well. And, you know, we could ask the question, what is the ultimate good at Walmart? You know, if the good includes the good of each individual person, if the business of business is the human person, then I don't think Walmart would be a particularly good example of that.
You've kind of talked about how you can either choose to prioritize profit maximization or God. Why isn't there a third option? Because you could be an atheist who chooses not to profit maximize, but rather to maximize their environmental impact on the earth and save the planet, mm-hmm. or maximize the way that they live their life in terms of, I don't know, happiness. They could maximize their own personal happiness, which isn't necessarily profit maximization, but rather joy maximization. And I just don't see how that would be work against either of those two things.
Okay, that's good. That's a good point. You know, I'm not saying that there are only two possible first things. The reason I choose profit as one is I think that's the one that reigns in business schools, generally speaking. So that one seems like a logical case. And the reason I choose Christ is because, as I answered before, I believe that is the I'm not an atheist, so I believe that that is the ultimate first good. So I chose what I thought was the ultimate first good and compared it to what I think is the in-place working first good of business schools and compared those. I mean, it would be a worthwhile paper to say, well, suppose we chose something else, custody of the environment or any number of other things, and we could compare those two in the same kind of way. So I wouldn't rule that out. There's space for everybody. But in my world, my cosmology, my, you know, there's only really two values that make sense to compare.
I'm a marketing professor. The purpose of marketing used to be to enhance well-being. But over the years, as we've enhanced well-being, it's moved more towards maximizing profits. But I still teach the marketing concept that is to aim all company efforts towards satisfying customer needs at a profit, not at maximum profit, but at a profit. Because mm-hmm. you got to have a profit to mm-hmm. stay in business and to pay your employees. But students come back to me with the... you know, that companies have this mission, this call to maximize shareholder value. So do we need, I guess, how do we change that? Or do we need to change get a new capitalism? Do we need to change that from that system perspective?
I understand. I appreciate your, I can see how that would happen in your courses, how students would come back to you with that. I think what is required is a metanoia, and part of that is a whole other way of thinking about things. You know, one of the things I'm coming to believe is that we live in an age that is metaphysically challenged, an age actually, and it's kind of an unmetaphysical age we live in. So ideas about being, you know, which are ideas which naturally call to God, which naturally call to these higher things, you know, can't get any attraction. There's no basis for them in a world where there is no such thing as being, where metaphysical questions are ruled out. So in a world where there's only objects in motion in time and space, you know, it's going to, you know, things, objectified understandings of the world, like profit would lend itself to, are going to reign. And there's no basis in the imagination for imagining another way of thinking about it. I think the Catholic Church is actually quite articulate about what an alternative ethos and way of thinking about business would be. I think it's written into its social principles, its social teachings. And I think you can find there something which doesn't have profit as the first thing, but quite to the contrary, sees profit as an ancillary or secondary thing at most.
I have a quick question. Do you see Catholic social thought as something, and some of these principles you brought up and even Scripture, as something that's primarily for Christians or for Catholics to use? Mm-hmm. Or how do you see that these things have been? Seems to me that there are companies that, for example, I think Patagonia is a company that's done a lot of good, but I don't think their leader is governed by any Christian ideas whatsoever, to my knowledge.
Right.
I think there's other companies like that. Maybe God uses them in the world. Or I remember one of my students, I've told my students this before, one of my MBA students a few years ago who really loved the vocation of a business leader document was actually a Shia Muslim from mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia. And he said, this is fantastic stuff. I mean, he couldn't get on board with a few of the things at the end encouraging you to go to mass every day and things
right.
like that.
Yeah.
But there still was a lot there that he could take from those teachings. So I just want you to yeah. speak to that a little
That's bit. A great question. I believe the Catholic social teaching is universal. I think it is the splendor of truth. I really do. And I think its anthropology is actually the much more sophisticated and true human anthropology. So what it assumes about people is correct, and so I think it is for everybody. I don't think Catholics believe that their social teaching is for them alone. I think they believe it's you know.
I do want to remind you once again. I like to do this at the end, that this whole thing is possible because some of our alums who have gone on and made money have given their money back. Instead of spending it on themselves, they've given it back so that others can hear talks like this tonight. So we especially want to thank Anderson Community Market and also F&M Bank in Dundee. They've been great, and those are alumni who have given back to help us here at school. Plus, Creighton University exists because people give back, right? So we're grateful for that, and that's sort of what you're talking about tonight in action. So let's give one more round of applause. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Lloyd Sandilands, professor of business administration and psychology at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, and author of several books, including The Nuptial Mind, Being at Work, and Love First, Toward a Christian Humanism. He spoke on the topic on the inhumanity of profit-seeking. Professor Sandilands' remarks were given as part of the Business, Faith, and Common Good speaker series presented by the Hyder College of Business at Creighton University. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, November 2, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 700 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.